Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Professor Gurunath Kilara, who will be speaking on cancer, some myths and reality. Currently, he is Chief Oncology Services, Curie Center of Oncology, St. John's Medical College, Bangalore. Dr. Kilara obtained his MBBS from St. John's Medical College, Bangalore in 1976 and MD from Postgraduate Institute of Medical Education and Research, Chandigarh, in 1980. From 1980 to 1990, he was at Kidwai Memorial Institute of Oncology, Bangalore. In 1990, he became the promoter director, Bangalore Cancer Hospital. This was the first cancer center in private sector in the country. During the period 1991 to 1995, Professor Kilara has played a significant role in the planning and establishment of Rajiv Gandhi Cancer Hospital and Research Center at New Delhi and also Curie Center of Oncology in Bangalore. In 1991, Professor Kilara had the distinction of performing the first iridium brachytherapy in Karnataka. In 1993, he performed the first iridium 192 brain implant brachytherapy in India. He has to his credit about 16 publications in national and international journals. He has been the visiting fellow at various universities in India and abroad. Among the honors conferred on him, a few are plaque of honor from Association of Radiation Oncologists of India, Karnataka chapter, and also plaque of honor from Karnataka State Medical and Dental Association. Ladies and gentlemen, may I now invite Professor Kilara to deliver his talk.
Dr. Ramana, Dr. Shetty, ladies and gentlemen, let me first of all say that it's a great honor to be here this evening, and it's a very pleasant change to find a non-medical organization, quote unquote, taking a keen interest in what's happening in fields like cancer. May I have my first set of slides, please? Okay, this one here is a painting by Rembrandt called The Anatomy Lesson. Fortunately for mankind, we've moved a long way from there, as you can see on the other side. We're in the age of computers now. Therefore, there's been a tremendous explosion of knowledge across the board, particularly in the field of medicine. However, in the field of medicine particularly, the practice is very closely associated with social norms, social values, social acceptability, and everything else. I remember in 1970 when I was a medical student in St. John's, there was a bus which used to pass in front of what was then the mental hospital, today NIMHANS. And I noticed that nobody would get off at that bus stop. Either they would get off before or after, but not at the bus stop because they would think you're a mental patient. Today, fortunately, we accept mental disease like any other physical disease. Take tuberculosis, for example. A couple of decades ago, they would run away to a hill station. It was a hush-hush word. Nobody was supposed to utter the word tuberculosis. He has, you know what, and then he's gone somewhere for treatment. Today, we accept it and say, all right, so-and-so has tuberculosis and he's on treatment. Unfortunately, in spite of all the advances in medicine, cancer has yet to be accepted socially. And this is very largely due to the fact that there are several misconceptions about cancer. Therefore, I thought it appropriate this evening to explore what is cancer, explore some of the myths which exist amongst us, and at the end of the evening, hopefully, leave you with what's possible in cancer, leave you with hope, leave you with some amount of knowledge of what's possible in cancer. Certainly in half an hour's time, one cannot do complete justice to the overall picture of cancer, but a bird's eye view is perhaps what you will get this evening. Next, please. One of the first things that people ask, all right, cancer, what is cancer? And if one were to define it, cancer is a purposeless, progressive, pathological proliferation of cells. Now, there are several key words here. The first is purposeless. Now, in the body, there are several cell systems, and normally they all coalesce to function as one. Each one has an individual function to perform. In cancer, the cell goes mad, as it were. It frees itself from all kinds of bonds and the things which normally determine the function which the cell has to serve. And therefore, it's a purposeless proliferation of cells. Second is the word pathological proliferation. There are some parts in the body which normally are meant to divide. If you cut your finger, for example, it heals by the cells growing. But there's a purpose in that. There's a regulatory mechanism operative, and the body knows exactly when to stop. In cancer, the cell escapes those regulatory mechanisms and therefore proliferates ad nauseum. And with it goes the fact that it can metastasize, it can travel to other parts of the body, settle down there, and start producing problems in other parts. So you have a primary tumor and you have metastatic disease, which is spread of the primary tumor to other parts of the body. Next, please. What causes cancer? The bottom line, really, ladies and gentlemen, is so far we do not know for sure what causes cancer. But if one were to list some of the things which are associated very closely with the occurrence of cancer, here is a very short list. Chemicals, viruses, hormones, ionizing radiation, occupation. There's a very interesting story in occupation, and I'm sure some of you would be interested in this. Sir Percival Pott in England was the first one to describe the association of occupation with cancer. And the way he made his observation was that in England you had these small boys who were chimney sweeps. Their job was to go up the chimney, open an umbrella, sit with their legs drawn up inside the chimney, and come down with the umbrella open so the soot would all get scraped off the walls. Now, he noticed that these young boys were developing cancers of the skin in the scrotal area. And he made the association that it was the soot which was falling on them causing cancer. After that, of course, there have been any number of instances linking occupation with cancer. To give you a more recent example, when radium dials were in vogue in watches, the women who would put those small dots of radium on the dial of the watch had a small thin brush, and they were supposed to dip that into the radium solution and just touch it on the various points. Now, to make the point sharp, they were constantly licking it, making it sharp, and then dipping it. Thereby, they were consuming radium, and they found that there was an increased incidence of leukemias in them. So there are several instances like this where occupation has been linked to cancer. Lifestyle and cancer, I think this is really the key word today. It's estimated that 2/3 of the cancers in this country are preventable because they're linked directly to lifestyle changes. What are those? Some of them, of course, you will see. Some of them you're aware of. Smoking, for example. Alcohol consumption, for example. In the social customs, it's very interesting to note that in the Vidarbha region, for example, they tie the dhoti extremely tight around their waist and they develop a skin cancer which is called the dhoti cancer. Up north in Kashmir, they use the kangri in winter and they keep the kangri in close contact with the skin and they develop kangri cancer. In China, there is a similar variety where the nasopharyngeal carcinomas are extremely high. So, I would like you to bear in mind that cancer is indeed extremely closely linked to lifestyles. And therefore, the logical thing to say would be, when we come to prevention of cancer, the key is to look at our lifestyles and see what we need to do there in order to prevent some of the cancers from occurring. Next. One of the greatest myths is that cancer is a modern disease. I often have people in their late 60s and 70s ask me, how come you're talking so much about cancer suddenly? When we were children, we never heard of it. When we were students, we never heard of it. How come everybody's talking about cancer now? Now, the myth is that it's a modern disease. It's really not a modern disease. As far back as Sushruta and Charaka's works in this country contain references to cancer. The reason why we are hearing more and more about cancer is a conglomeration of various factors which have happened over the years. We've conquered most of the killer infectious diseases. Longevity has increased, lifestyles have changed, diagnostic tools have improved, and therefore what we are seeing now is a sudden increase in cancer. But is that really true? Is it really a major problem? Should we be talking about it? The answer certainly is yes. The WHO estimates that somewhere in the year 2020 to 2025, cancer will be the number one killer disease in this country. It's going to overtake all the other major causes of death. And therefore, if we are to do something about the cancer scene, this is probably the time, although it's late in the day, better late than never, this is the time to start. The other thing is that cancer really is not unique to man. Animals suffer from it. There's an example of a tiger from the Banerghatta Park who had a tumor. Laboratory studies, more often than not, are done on mice and rats and all the other animals that you can possibly think of. So cancer really is not unique to man. Next, please. Cancer is not curable. This is really a myth which has got perpetuated over the years, thanks very largely to the kind of ignorance which exists not just in the lay people, but even within the medical community, I'm sorry to say. Today's fact is that 2/3 of our cancers are curable. Now, it sounds very funny to some of you when you hear the word cure being used along with cancer. Now, what do we mean by cure? Arbitrarily, if one were to fix some time frame, let's say 5 years, and at the end of 5 years, if the patient has no symptoms, if the doctor cannot find anything on examination, and all the available tests do not prove the presence of cancer in that person, then from that point onwards, that person's lifespan is exactly the same as anybody else, whose same social strata, sex, age, and everything else which determines longevity. And we are saying that 2/3 of our cancers are curable today. Now, if you think of it, diabetes, no cure. For the rest of your life, you've got to live with it, you've got to make your lifestyle adjustments, take all the medication, the exercise, and everything else, and yet, at the end of the day, the target organs in the body will get affected by diabetes. Take hypertension, high blood pressure, no cure. I'm talking about essential hypertension, no cure. You've got to take medication, low salt, make all your lifestyle changes, exercise and everything else, and yet at the end of the day, your chances of heart attacks, your chances of stroke are much higher than the normal population. But in cancer, we are saying 2/3 of them are curable. So the myth that I would like to demolish this evening is that cancer is not curable. You might well ask, what about the other 1/3? Certainly you're not curing those. Which brings me really to the philosophy of medicine. Why do we practice medicine, whatever specialty across the board? I think somewhere in our medical education and the social setup, we have this extremely confused and wrong notion that doctors are gods and doctors can give life, grant life. I think that's a very arrogant attitude on the part of the medical profession. We treat, it's he who cures. So our job really is, at the end of the day, to see that human suffering is limited. To see that somebody can live as long as he or she is on this earth as comfortably as possible. That's the basic objective of all medicine, and cancer medicine is no different. And towards that end, certainly even those 1/3 in whom we say we cannot cure, we can certainly improve their quality of life. So the central issue has shifted from the time when we were saying cure, no cure, to saying, what can I do to improve the quality of life of this individual? We shall see later on in the talk what is it that we can do for some of these patients. Next, please. Am I just saying cure, or is there really proof of cure? Some quick results, seminoma of the testes, look at these excellent results. Anal canal cancers, look at those results. Very, very satisfactory. Next. carcinoma of the prostate, carcinoma of the bronchus. I could really go on and on about cancers where these cure rates look extremely respectable. So we have a very good chance of curing 2/3 of our cancers. So this is just to make that point. Next. Right. Cancer is contagious. I'm always amazed at the ignorance in this field in society. Extremely educated people, when they get relatives of theirs from outside who want to come and stay with them to take cancer treatment in some of the bigger cities, shun them and shoo them away because they think cancer is contagious and they have small children at home. And it's quite a task to convince them that cancer definitely is not contagious. There is nothing on proof to say that you can transmit cancer from one person to the other. On your right there, it says, is cancer hereditary? This is a borrowed slide and says yes. And I put that in again to demonstrate. This is a medical colleague of mine who had this slide, and it says cancer is hereditary, and I would like to take a little point with him on this. Really, it's not hereditary in the truest sense. It has a genetic trait, yes. There is clustering of cancer within families, yes. But in the truest sense, cancer is not a hereditary disease. At the present level of knowledge, to put it very roughly, what we believe is that there are genes in the body identified as oncogenes. Now, these are like electric switches. You can switch them on and the person becomes susceptible to cancer. Some of the factors which switch on this gene are what you saw earlier. The factors which we say are associated as causative factors for cancer. But that really does not make cancer a hereditary disease. In breast cancer, certainly there's a clustering within families. And if somebody in your family has breast cancer, the ladies related, blood related to that patient, certainly have a slightly higher incidence of breast cancer within them. So we use that as the focal point to educate more and more people about breast cancer, about the importance of self-examination, mammography, and everything else. Next. On your right there are some of the signs or symptoms that might be associated with cancer. The acronym reads CAUTION. First, change in bowel or bladder habits. A sore which is non-healing. Unusual bleeding or discharge from the body. Thickening or lump in the breast or anywhere else in the body. Indigestion or difficulty in swallowing. Obvious change in a wart or a mole which might have existed for several years but you suddenly notice that it's increasing in size. Nagging cough or hoarseness of voice. All these could be symptoms of cancer. But before you rush saying, oh God, I got cancer, there's that little note. These are only indications. They are not proof positive. So if you have a cough, please do not jump to the conclusion that straight away you have cancer. It does need a lot of investigative modalities before we can establish that. What are the facilities available presently for cancer diagnosis and therapy? I'll quickly take you through what's possible somewhere else and then zero in on what's possible in Bangalore right at your doorstep. Next. Some of the diagnostic tools. These five on your left are the basic investigations. The hemogram, which consists of your hemoglobin levels, the total count, the differential count, the platelet count, which really generally talks about your health. Health and well-being may not be related to cancer, but if there is cancer, we need to look at totality of the body, and therefore these are necessary. Biochemical parameters, how are your kidneys functioning? How is the liver functioning? Anything else happening in the blood? That's the biochemistry. A chest x-ray, which is a very fundamental investigation. I've heard some of the junior doctors call these routine investigations. I don't believe there is anything called routine in medicine. It's got to be tailored. And these are perhaps better referred to as baseline investigations. You need a baseline to establish whether the patient has cancer or not. And this is the panel which normally we use. Out of these, the last one, biopsy or cytology, I'd just like to spend a few moments on this. A biopsy is removal of tissue from the body and sending it for pathological examination. Cytology is the study of cells which may be shed from the body. So there is a difference. A biopsy is a surgical procedure. You need to cut the skin, get at whatever lump that you're talking about, take it out and send it for pathological examination. Cytology is merely taking body fluids, which may be normal or abnormal, putting it under the microscope and studying those cells. And the scientist who made this possible was a person called Papanicolaou. And this is the famous Pap test. All ladies after the age of 40 are recommended to undergo a Pap smear once every year. What the Pap smear consists of really is taking a little smear from the cervix under visualization. So the gynecologist puts the patient in the position that they normally examine and take a little smear from there. It doesn't hurt, very mildly uncomfortable, but whatever secretions are there, it's put on a slide and sent off to the cytologist, who then stains it with the Papanicolaou stain and then tells you whether it's normal or normal. The importance of that is that before actual cancer develops, particularly in carcinoma cervix, which is the killer in this country, it's possible to diagnose precancerous conditions by the use of this simple Pap test. And therefore, we would do very well not only to undergo it ourselves where appropriate, but also to spread the message across that Pap smear is certainly well worth doing. Next. This is a mammogram on your left. And a mammogram is a special X-ray of the breast. It's delineated very well. And what you do see are things like what you're seeing here. This little calcification, striated like that, that's classical of a cancerous growth in the breast. You could have more lumps which are benign in the breast than malignant. And a mammogram is really what the American Cancer Society recommends for those above 40 as well as those who are at high risk. So if somebody in your family has breast cancer, you do very well to have a mammogram every year after the age of 40. If there's nobody in your family who has breast cancer, after the age of 45, just like you would go through the master health checkups in other hospitals, you'd probably do very well to have a mammography. On your right is the simple procedure of the Pap smear that I was talking about. That's the slide, and that's the little spatula which we use to take a little bit of secretion, put it on this slide. So it's a very, very simple procedure which can be done even in the smallest of clinics. Next. There are some newer techniques. Immunohistochemistry, cytogenetics, which is coming in a large way, which is really studying the genetic component of the cells which are removed from the body. MRI spectroscopy. MRI is magnetic resonance imaging. Like you had CT scan as one of the diagnostic tools, on that side in the earlier slide, you must have noticed MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. It's a newer modality of imaging which can go right to the functional level. And these days, with MRI spectroscopy, it's possible to actually predict, and Dr. Kalyan Sundaram and I were at a very interesting lecture the other day where this was amply demonstrated, that MRI spectroscopy certainly is in a position today to predict even the nature of what you see on the film. So we are now down to the functional levels. We can now see what the cell is doing, how malignant is it? Is it malignant? Is it related to treatment? Is it related to the cancer? Is it related to something else? With great accuracy. Tumor markers are substances which are produced by tumors within the body. The classical example is what is called the beta unit of the human chorionic gonadotropin, beta HCG. Add to that the alpha fetoprotein and so many else. For ovarian malignancies, you have several other markers which you can use. So there are several tumors in the body, several cancers in the body, which are associated very closely with chemical substances called tumor markers. And if you find a diagnosis, this particular tumor marker elevated in the blood of the patient, Now you have a tool with which you can monitor what happens to that cancer as you go through treatment and follow-up. If that level comes down, it indicates that the treatment is successful. It remains down for some time, and over a period of time, gradually the levels start rising again. More often than not, you can suspect that the cancer is coming back somewhere in the body. You may be able to demonstrate it with all the latest sophisticated techniques. You may not be able to. Yet, it would be sufficient to say that there is some tumor activity going on within the body based on tumor markers. On the other side, I have two terms: early detection of cancer and detection of early cancer. Early detection of cancer means that the cancer has probably been in the body for some time and you're picking it up relatively early compared to somebody else. You're picking it up early. So far, all the diagnosis things that I have shown you operate basically on the principle of early detection of cancer. And that ensures that 60% of our cancers can be cured. But the crux in the coming future is in the next one: detection of early cancer. Before cancer develops into a stage where it's not treatable, picking the cancer up at that stage, using pap smears, using mammography, using self-examination of breast, using some of the tumor markers and everything else that's coming onto the field, if we can reach a stage where we can catch the cell even before it turns cancerous, that would really be the day when cancer would be totally preventable. Next. Right, the treatments. I'll quickly run through surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and the BRMs are the biological response modifiers which are coming onto the field just now. In surgery, the principles are, this is operation, so surgery is synonymous with removal of tissue. It's removal of diseased organs along with relevant nodes and surrounding structures. It restores functionality as much as possible, and it preserves vital organs or functions without compromising the cure. So that's really the principle of cancer surgery. Next. Based on that, there was of course a time, on that side and the right side, when several specialists would be eyeball to eyeball confrontation like that, saying this is my domain, this is my domain. Surgeon would say he can cure more, radiation oncologist would say no, I can cure more. Fortunately, we've shifted from there and come to an era of organ preservation. The principles of organ preservation are that the treatment option which we offer must offer the maximum potential of cure. So we don't want to compromise on cancers which can be cured. There should be no increase in complications as a result of preserving the organ. At the same time, cosmesis and functional results ought to be maintained as much as possible. And it's based on these that we shall see some examples of using a particular technique of radiation therapy called brachytherapy, which will take us into what is possible there. Next. Here is the great lady, Madame Curie, whom all of you know and after whom my center is named. She was the first one to discover the first naturally occurring isotope, radium. Radiation therapy is of two parts. One could be the external beam with cobalt-60. Or with linear accelerators. Just a point to say that there is again a myth that without a linear accelerator you cannot do good radiation therapy, and I would beg to differ with that. In this country, you have head and neck cancers as your main problem. You have cervical cancers as your main problem. You have a population which is not very heavy, very big set. And in those technical conditions, a cobalt machine can do an equally good job in 95% of our cases. The 5% who require it, yes, there are bigger institutions where such facilities are available. But bulk of the cancers can be treated extremely well using a cobalt machine, provided you know how to do it. The second part is brachytherapy, which is really putting radioactive material in and around cancerous tissues. Professor Ramana pioneered the development of isotopes in this country, which has made it possible for us today to practice brachytherapy. Next. To practice good quality radiotherapy, I said a cobalt machine is sufficient. It's sufficient provided you have these support facilities. You need a dedicated X-ray machine called a simulator X-ray machine. You need a computerized treatment planning system. You need a mold room, and you need several other sophistications built into the system in order to practice what's called precision radiation therapy. And when we say precision, we are saying the dose variations are plus minus 5%. So if you said a particular unit of 40 gray, the only latitude you have is plus minus 5% of that. Coming to brachytherapy, and I will spend a little time on this evening, it's also called plesiotherapy, which is short distance therapy. And the Americans like to be different in everything that they do, and therefore they call this endocuri therapy. Basically, it's short distance therapy. So compared to teletherapy, where the source of radiation is at a distance from the patient, brachytherapy is where you put radioactive material very close to the tumor. You might put it into body cavities, in which case it's called intracavitary. You might put it into tumor tissues, in which case it's called an interstitial implant, or you may mold it to the surface of the body. So those are the three types of brachytherapy. Next. The physics basis of brachytherapy is that there is a particular law called the inverse square law, which makes it possible for radiation to fall off very rapidly as you move away from the radiation source. And what that does is to protect the surrounding tissues, surrounding normal tissues, from exposure to excessive radiation. In external beam therapy, one does not have such total control over radiation to the normal tissues. In the practice of brachytherapy, we're able to do that very well. The clinical basis of using the brachytherapy technique, of course, is that you can give a high dose of radiation to a small volume and therefore increase chances of survival. Over the years, we've had several improved sources, and the BRC today is in a position to supply us with an isotope called iridium-192. Not radium, which Madame Curie discovered, that was Ra, this is iridium, iridium-192. Supplied in the form of wires, which are malleable, and therefore they can take the contour of the tumor. And we're really very close to getting to a point where we can match the radiation dose distribution three-dimensionally with the configuration of the tumor tissues, something called conformational therapy. So the therapy will conform to the three dimensions in which the tumor occurs within the body. Next. The sources we use, cobalt-60, cesium, and I mentioned iridium-192. There are some permanent implants which they do abroad, but unfortunately we do not have access to those isotopes right now. Therefore, whatever you'll be seeing here is with the iridium-192 isotopes. Next. This is the iridium isotope. It's available here. It has a half-life of 72 days, very convenient to work with, and BRC is extremely prompt in supplying us with new sources every time we order them. The rationale for using iridium implants: we saw organ conservation, and at that point we said minimum surgery combined with radiation can give you equally good results and yet preserve the organ. Next. One of the classical examples of being able to do that is breast cancer. There was a time when mastectomy, or removal of the breast, was the only recommended treatment for breast cancer as the primary treatment. Then, of course, you could add radiation and whatever else that you wanted, but basically it consisted of removal of the breast. People then adapted the whole concept of breast conservation. Is it possible for us to conserve the organ and yet give you high results of cure? This is data comparing the classical Halsted. William Halsted was the man who developed that radical mastectomy of yesteryears, which incidentally still is the gold standard of any kind of major surgery that you can do on the body. But they compared that with a technique where you remove only a part of the breast, an operation which is called quadrantectomy or lumpectomy. You just remove the lump. It's cancerous, just remove the lump. And then combine it with radiotherapy. Look at these results, absolutely comparable. So we are now saying that doing less surgery, combining it with radical radiation, will give you exactly the same results as you were getting with the classical systems of therapy. On your right there is a lady marked for doing what's called a breast implant, which you will see shortly, the tubes running across there. Next. Before we do that, one has to be very careful that the radiation which is delivered through teletherapy, the external radiation, the cobalt radiation or the linear accelerator radiation, is given in a manner where underlying tissues, in the case of the breast, the lung, is spared whatever radiation that it can. Before the onset and advent of computers in the treatment planning, we had no way of verifying whether the radiation beam that we were using would go to the underlying lungs or not. With the advent of CT scans, we decided to study whether the markings that we were putting on the patients based on classical anatomical locations, whether that was accurate enough for us or not. And that's the result of a little study we did on 72 patients. In 50% of them, we were fortunate there was no lung within the radiation field. But in the remaining 50%, certainly there was lung tissue included in the radiation field. Next. You will see the two CT scans here. On your left, radiation beam coming in there and passing off like that and coming in laterally and going off medially there. That's the lung. And you will notice that the radiation beam is just grazing there and there is no radiation reaching the lung in this particular instance. However, on the other side, this dotted line represents the radiation beam again. And look at the number of amount of lung tissue which would have got included in the radiation beam had we not taken care to do a CT scan and use computerized radiation therapy planning. So the lesson we learned from this is that computerization, use of CT scan simulation is an absolute must for accurate delivery of radiation doses. Next. That's the actual procedure. There are needles there which are passed into the breast tissue on those marks which you saw in the previous slide. They are then replaced with plastic tubing, and that's the completed procedure. Next. That's the result. It's really extremely difficult to say which side was irradiated. The cosmetic results are that good. In a large study from France, multicentric, 12,000 women who underwent this procedure, the acceptable cosmesis results were 97%. So in 97% of women with early breast cancer, it's possible to undertake this kind of therapy and give these kind of excellent cosmetic results and yet maintain the cure rates that we saw earlier. Moving on from breast cancer to another very interesting area of cervical cancers, this is a newer technique of brachytherapy which is called the perineal template brachytherapy, fortunately developed by an Indian, Dr. Nisar Sayed, at the Memorial Long Beach Hospital in California. Dr. Nisar is from Hyderabad but has settled in America, as several people have done. He developed a technique by which it's possible to put in radioactive material right into the pelvis. This is the pelvic bone. This is a CT scan picture, so actually you're seeing a cut section like that. This is the pelvic bone. These are representative of the needles which will carry the radioisotope in them. With this, it's possible now to irradiate large areas which normally were not possible. In this country, carcinoma cervix being 50% of cancers in females, such perineal template brachytherapy has extreme relevance. Even in the late stages of carcinoma cervix, where we were treating 20%, we were curing 20% of cancers at 5 years, with the use of this technique, we have moved those figures up to 60%. So it's certainly something which is well worth doing, and we've started doing that in our center. Next. Other several quick examples in the head and neck area, whether it's tongue, tonsil, buccal mucosa, floor of the mouth, you can use brachytherapy in several instances. And see these patients, they have the isotope in here in these small tubes loaded in there. Absolutely comfortable walking around within the confines of that room meant specifically for that purpose. Very comfortable. They stay with the sources in them for periods of up to 48 hours, 72 hours, depending on the dose that we're delivering. These tubes are then pulled out, which does not require any anesthesia, and they go home. The reactions are extremely local within the area that you did the implant, and they settle down in 7 to 10 days. After that, organ is preserved, the cancer is gone. So functionality as well as cure, both ensured. Next. Another example, this is a cancer called a soft tissue sarcoma. occurs in the large limbs, occurs in the muscle mass. Normally, the medical answer to such a cancer would have been to cut the leg off, an amputation. Today, thanks to brachytherapy, we don't need to do that. We can do what's called a compartmental excision, very limited removal of tissue from the body, use external radiation, and then adapt the brachytherapy here to deliver radiation to this large volume. As you can see, that's the procedure and this is the completed one, and thereby save the limb. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the epitome of what I said earlier about quality of life. This is what the aim of all treatment ought to be. This is where cancer treatment is headed today. Next. One particular area where we have been spearheading work in the country is brain implants. In foreign countries, this has been done for a very long time. As you can see, almost 20 years ago the work started. But there, we normally use three-dimensional treatment planning and you need stereotactic frames and everything else. Next. So you need a very, very high sophistication. In this country, we do not have stereotactic frames in most places. We do not have three-dimensional treatment planning system. And the question we asked ourselves then was, under these circumstances, is it possible for us to do brain implants in this country, given the fact that we get iridium-192 wires, which are temporary implants? That's the lady whom we did the first implant on. Next. That's during the treatment. This is her CT scan, and you can see the needles sitting very nicely within the brain tissue, and that's the side view of the needles being put. Next. Likewise, this gentleman, two views of him undergoing treatment. This little konde on his head is actually a stainless steel glass which we have inverted on top of his head to take care of the sources which are coming out of there. So it's an improvisation of what's available, works extremely well. They're in the ward for 18 hours, 20 hours, take off the sources and they go home. The procedure is actually turning out to be so simple that it sounds very ridiculous. The patient walks into the CT scan room, sits on the couch, we mark where we want to put the needle, inject local anesthesia, and the needle goes right through. If you work with a neurosurgeon who does not put the bone flap back. Patient has a CT scan, goes into the brachytherapy room, load the sources, 18 hours, 20 hours, patient is there, remove the sources, the patient goes home. The advantage being that with this technique, we're able to deliver a high dose of radiation to a small volume where the brain tumor was originally. Next. Another example, with the use of the MRI, the magnetic resonance imaging, we can now do calculations of volume of the tumor tissue. Next. And then go ahead and do an implant based on that. Here is an example of that. Gentleman sitting and watching television quite comfortably. That's his CT scan showing the orientation of the sources. So, next please. So it's now possible, we conclude, to do iridium implants in this country. It's a question of being interested in it and pursuing it long enough. Next. On your left is a very famous painting called The Night Watch by Rembrandt. And I put that in to make the point that quality assurance of cancer therapy is of utmost importance. We need to be on our guard, we need to be on the watch, on the lookout constantly, to make sure that the treatment that we're giving adheres to the levels of delivering the dose only to the tissues where they need to be delivered. Next. What are the future directions? Some of them, I predict, are, some of them are in techniques, and I really would not bother you with that. This is really interesting. We might be looking at being able to culture these cells directly in petri dishes and determining whether they're going to be sensitive to radiation or they're going to be sensitive to chemotherapy, which particular drug in chemotherapy, what doses, and so on. We're nowhere near that yet. But the work does indicate that pretty soon, in clinical practice, we might be able to do this on a routine basis. Hypoxic cell sensitizers, several substances which have been used to make sure that the oxygen supply to the cancer cells increases relative to the normal tissues and therefore radiation is able to act better. Work has been done on several substances, but as yet there is no substance which has been developed satisfactorily. The flaw being that the normal tissue as well as the cancer tissue both get sensitized to radiation and therefore we lose the effect of that substance. Next. I would now change tack. You've seen what's possible in some parts of treatment. And I said earlier, we would come back to prevention. This is again a myth that it's not preventable. Let's see what's possible. Next. The next few slides bring back to you some of the things which you probably have heard ad nauseum, what you ought not to do in life. At the risk of repetition, smoking, which is the greatest risk factor of all, alcohol, upper aerodigestive tract tumors of the head and neck, lungs, bladder, several other tumors which are associated with regular consumption of alcohol. Next. Avoid being overweight. Some cancers are associated with extreme overweight. And obesity is certainly something which needs to be avoided. The actinic rays of the sun are not filtered sufficiently. And one of the concerns of environmentalists with the ozone holes and everything else is that you would get more and more actinic rays in and increase the incidence of skin cancers. In fact, in foreign countries, there are special clinics run only for skin cancers. Fortunately, in this country, thanks to the dark melanin pigmentation of our skin, we are not as susceptible to skin cancers as those in the north. Having said that, if you are going to be taking very regular holidays on the beaches of Goa, please beware, be very careful that you do not let too much of actinic rays get onto your skin. Next. Observe health and safety regulations at work. Like I mentioned, there are several cancers associated with occupations, and all environmentalists, all industrialists, all medical professionals need to be aware of the risks and dangers of the environment in which we work. Cut down on fatty foods, again something which is advised for more diseases than one, so also for cancer. There's a very interesting Japanese study where they have shown that eating of fresh vegetables, carrots, green vegetables, they decrease the incidence of cancer very dramatically. So one of the things that they advise is for us to have what was classically, conventionally, our own traditional diet in this country, consisting of lots of fresh vegetables. Unfortunately, we've moved away from there. We need to come back. Next. Eat plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables. It always takes a foreigner for some reason for us to come to our senses. And I'm hoping that this sort of a thing will go down very well. See your doctor if there is any unexplained change in your normal health. Please remember that slide which said caution of all those symptoms. If those symptoms do not settle, you do very well to consult a medical specialist as soon as possible. Next. Have a regular cervical pap smear. I covered that already. Examine your breasts monthly. Self-examination of the breasts for women is an extremely simple technique, and we need to propagate that more and more in our women. It does not take education. It does not take sophistication. All that it requires is awareness. This technique is just simple, using the palm of your hand to palpate various parts of your breast on a regular basis on both sides. So you come to know the feel of your normal breasts under normal circumstances. The moment there is a change, the human hand is sensitive enough to pick up those changes. And you would then do very well to report to a medical practitioner to take whatever further steps might be necessary. Next. Right, the last part. If you remember, I said that the whole principle of the practice of medicine is quality of life. And we cannot talk of quality of life if we divorce psychological factors from the practice of medicine. So it's a myth, really, to say that there is no role of psychology in treatment of cancer. The kind of stress that cancer patients go through are indeed tremendous. They may be related to the disease itself, the personal distress. There could be familial, social, occupational, financial distress. There could be treatment-related distress, radiation therapy, the chemotherapy. A word about chemotherapy, incidentally, I did not put in any slides for lack of time, but just a quick word. There is a myth that chemotherapy is extremely painful. Let's demolish that. Chemotherapy is not painful. It's like any other intravenous therapy that you might have received, except that the drugs you're using are toxic, and therefore you have to be monitored extremely closely. It does not mean pain. It does not mean being away from your work. You can continue to work, come and take your treatment on a Saturday if you're not working, go back to work on Monday morning. It's really that simple. There are some do's and don'ts, but nothing which essentially interferes with your quality of life. Coming back to this, terminal care and hospice care and pain relief are something which we need to address extremely importantly in this country. Next. And towards that end, at the Curie Center, we decided to try a little experiment. Whatever cancer patients had been telling us over the years, in terms of what kind of an environment they're looking for, what are they scared of in hospitals, there is a syndrome called the white coat syndrome, where patients on radiation therapy and chemotherapy start vomiting the moment they enter the portals of the institution. Nothing to do with the drug, nothing to do with the treatment. Everything to do with the kind of environment we create for them, the atmosphere we create for them. So we decided to be different. Nobody in my hospital wears white aprons. The nurses are not in white uniforms. The linen is not white. Every time we give a chemotherapy, the bottle is covered. We've had patients say that they have nightmares of that red medicine going through as if it was blood. We have had patients say that they visualize the nurses and the doctors in white aprons coming with this big syringe in their hand to try and poke them and kill them. And that's the reason why dropout rates from treatment, whether for radiation or for chemotherapy, are extremely large. We are trying a little experiment to see whether we can give quality medical care minus all the psychological disadvantages. And there is this new field called psycho-oncology. And there is some evidence now beginning to come in of a field called psycho-neuro-immunology. We all know that the mind and the body are interrelated. But for some reason, medical training trains us only for the physical model. If there's disease, I look at that lump and I know what to do with it, but not what to do with the psychological impact, what to do with the person as a whole. We are now beginning to get evidence that psychological factors might be operating through our immune system. And that's the reason why we might have several immunological parameters disturbed in cancer. We have an active department of psycho-oncology, and as a principle, all patients at the Curie first go through psycho-oncology. Because as you know, it's not just the patient, but the patient and their entire family which need support, which need counseling. At the same time, it's not lay counseling. It's not you and I who can just sit down and counsel a cancer patient. That more often than not does more harm than good. We need somebody who's aware of how to take apart some of the psychological fears, more importantly, how to put them back and send them back in a positive frame of mind. The environment we create is in keeping with that. Next, please. That's the brachytherapy ward, and of course a lot of prayer which goes into everything that we practice. Next. Finally, we do need a team without which any endeavor is useless. And this is the great team that I have at the Curie, every little one of whom contributes to whatever we are doing to our patients. Next, please. In the end, ladies and gentlemen, I quote from George Bernard Shaw. He says, "The reasonable man adapts himself to the conditions that surround him. The unreasonable man adapts the surrounding conditions to himself. All progress depends on the unreasonable man." And I do believe that you and I together will make a whole lot of unreasonable men in this country to make a dent on the cancer problem in this country. Thank you very much for a patient hearing. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer. Yes. We have a whole host of new drugs which are now available to counter the nausea and the vomiting. There is a drug called ondansetron, which you might have heard of. It's called Zofur in this country, one of the brand names, which is extremely efficient in controlling the nausea and vomiting of chemotherapy. Having said that, it's a very individual reaction, and you might need to use several other drugs in conjunction in order to prevent that nausea and vomiting. What we do find is that to a very large extent, it's also got to do a lot with the mind. And patients who are positively inclined to their treatment, want to live and make the best of what they have, They are the ones who do not have as much nausea and vomiting. As far as hair loss is concerned, yes, there are several anti-cancer drugs which do cause hair loss. But the spectrum of loss is very large. You may have absolutely no hair loss, you may have very little hair loss, not noticeable, you may have the extreme where they go completely bald. The only guarantee in that is that the hair comes back once you stop treatment. And it's towards that end that we need to make the patient see that it's a temporary phenomenon. And there are excellent wigs available, there are lots of things which can be done to kind of make the lady see that this is a temporary phenomenon that she can put up with even if it happens. For some reason, I noticed that the patients from Kerala do not lose as much hair as anybody else. This is unscientific. This is just my observation. But maybe it's a coconut oil. We don't know. But Professor Ramana is here and he has set up such an excellent system of radiation protection, radiation monitoring all across the country. We have a system where there's a radiation safety officer certified and trained by the Atomic Energy Regulatory Board. And it's his job to make sure that all isotopes handled anywhere are handled within the allowed norms. In addition, we have a monitoring system. You must have seen us wear some of those peculiar looking badges, the wrist badges and the film badges that we wear. Each month this goes to Bombay, it's analyzed, and all radiation workers all over the country, not just radiation therapy, but you might be working in a lab, you might be working in an X-ray installation, they're all monitored on a regular monthly basis. And at the first indication or hint that the person has received even slightly more than radiation than what he or she should have received, there's an emergency call. Each of us has a number, so we are registered there and we get a call. I remember once when I was doing my post-graduation, I did get such a call. And they said, what is this boy doing? He's been overexposing himself to radiation. And in those days, we were holding radium and doing the work. We did not have access to iridium. So the chances were quite real at that point that you might have had overexposure. But then I noticed that my film badge, I had left next to the X-ray machine. So naturally, every time an X-ray was exposed, that film was recording more and more radiation. So I was off work. I had a holiday for about a week till they discovered that this is what had happened. And then they cleared me for that. But apart from that, we have not had any accidents as such happen. Yes, sir. Thank you. You want me to take the second question first? It's a more interesting question. This happens day in and day out. Just this afternoon, I heard of a similar instance. There's a gentleman in Bombay who has a miracle cure for cancer. He takes blood out, mixes it with some fluid, and injects it back into the system. But this particular gentleman, I also happen to know five or six of my patients who went there. They were all terminal. We had said that there's not much that we can offer. And they all came back and said, that man said, you've come very late. If you had come earlier, they cured you. But yes, it's true that the alternate systems of medicine certainly would have something for cancer, because this is a disease, as I said, which has been there for generations, millennia. So certainly there must be something. It's just that we do not know sufficient about those systems. And it's high time that we started adapting some of those. If you look at the anti-cancer drugs, several of them are plant products, which is probably what they were using in an unrefined form earlier. Some jadi booty which they would cut and grind and give it to the patient if they came back. Over and above all this, there is this phenomenon of spontaneous regression. I said that the immune system has a tremendous role to play in cancer control. For some reason, which we are not clear about yet, the human immune system is in a position at times to take care of tumor burden in the body, which normally it would not be in a position to do. Any number of times we say, okay, this patient, not much we can do, sorry, we'll give some painkillers and so on, take the patient home, keep them comfortable. I remember a lady I was called to see once, extremely large breast cancer. I said, don't do anything, please. And the husband said, no, we have small children, please give something, please give, please. So I prescribed an anti-cancer tablet, knowing fully well that that was not going to be working. It was just convenience because the man was bleeding. 4 months later, I got a call from the referring doctor saying, you remember this lady? And I thought he was going to say, well, she passed away this morning. And he said, well, could you please come and see her again? And I go there and lo and behold, the tumor is gone. Now, there is no way that that tablet which I had prescribed could have been solely responsible for getting rid of that disease. But yes, there was a time when she was completely symptom-free, no cancer palpable in the body. 2 months later, she was back in Kidwai, very advanced disease, passed away very soon. So there's a probably a cyclical phenomena where the human body is able to control the disease for some time, it will escape again. Secondly, the lay press has this rather obnoxious habit of rushing into print anything which makes sensational news. Man bites dog will make news, dog bites man, nobody bothers. So it's that kind of news that they will look for. Come to your first question. Cancer phobia certainly is catching up more and more. And one of the reasons why I hesitate to say some of the things I said this evening is precisely this. That I'd have the whole audience rushing out straight away to their doctor and saying, I've got cancer. We had a cancer specialist. He said, if I have cough, I have cancer. That's why the caution at the bottom of that slide. We need to be aware that taking care of our health is our own responsibility. And born out of that will be the diet, the exercise, the regular checkups and everything else. So it's not an isolation that one can take. And I'm hoping that our level of awareness will increase with gatherings like this and institutions like this to a level where people will become more aware of the real situation. Sir, before the cell becomes cancerous, as we saw, it passes through various stages. One of the stages of abnormality is called dysplasia. But it's not an abnormality which has become cancer. If left alone, a significant number of them reach cancer. So when you do a pap smear, you will get reports of dysplasia sometimes, which means that the cells from the part from which they were taken are certainly not normal, yet at the end of the spectrum, they are not cancerous. So you need to keep a very close watch. You need to repeat that pap smear maybe once in 3 months, once in 6 months, and pick up as soon as you think that this is definitely now going into cancer. So that's dysplasia. Pancreatic cancer, unfortunately, is one of the cancers which has evaded very significant amounts of cures, no matter what you do, for the simple reason that by the time the patient presents, has enough symptoms to go to a doctor, the cancer is very large and it has spread and got stuck all over the place. There's a very large operation called a Whipple's operation, which is the operation of choice for pancreatic cancers. Following that, we have some brachytherapy procedures abroad now where we can put in radioactive sources into that area to give a large dose of radiation. But in spite of all that, results are still dismal. One of the things which we can possibly do is to relieve the pain of pancreatic cancer by various surgical techniques, drugs and everything else. So that's possible. A certain definite indication, particularly from Japan, where in relation to passive smoking, for example, they have seen that passive smokers have a much higher incidence of lung cancer than in non-passive smokers. So those who are not exposed to any kind of smoke. And here the picture we are talking about is probably much worse, because it's just not cigarette smoke, the hell of a lot of other things in the environment which we are breathing in. The trouble arises because we are not in a position to conduct a controlled trial. And therefore, it's very difficult to say that it was X pollutant which resulted in an increase of cancer. But across the board, yes, pollution would certainly increase cancer incidence. Yes, ma'am. Well, I'm sure like all fields of science, medical science also is subject to the same kinds of pulls and pressures of industry and the lobbies and everything else. But I think it's rather far-fetched to think that somebody would be able to keep down good quality research which shows any great impact on cancer in the immunology field or some other field, merely because of financial interest. You may be able to do it for a year or 2 years, stall it for 6 months, but certainly not keep it down for longer than that. Okay. Good. The cost for the perineal template or the breast implants that you saw is in the region of about 10 to 11,000 rupees. The external radiation for 5 weeks would be in the region of 7 to 8,000 rupees. So you're really talking about a total, if you combine external and the brachytherapy, somewhere about 20, 22,000 all inclusive. That's what it costs. Medicine, who used to say that the biggest diagnosis is between the two human ears. So it's the brain of the person who's looking at the patient which becomes all important. One has to have the awareness that there is cancer and this is the most probable site of metastasis. Then, of course, there are enough and more tools available these days. I talked about CT scans and MRs and MR spectroscopy, pap smears, mammography, the list is very, very long, where we can attempt to try and pick up the metastasis. Having said that, biologically, let's say for breast cancer, by the time we think we've detected a very early tumor which is 2 centimeters in size, in the lab there is enough data to suggest that this tumor has been growing within the body for anywhere up to 8 to 10 years. So if the cancer has been growing in the body for that length of time, and we know that it has the potential to spread, it's more than likely that some cells might have escaped from there and might be sitting very dormant in other parts of the body, waiting for an opportune moment. If the human immune system is in a position to get rid of those cells as being foreign, then you have cures. If it does not, then this dormant cell sitting somewhere else in the body could start growing in that new site and produce problems. So, when a patient, we miss metastases, it may be very likely that the available diagnostic tools are not sensitive enough as yet to go down to that one cell, two cell level to pick up those metastases. So that may be a limitation of the investigation as well.
Dr. Gurunath Chilaga, ladies and gentlemen. When we were told that we are going to get an excellent speaker, because one of the criterion for being invited here is not necessarily being a top man in his field, but he must be top man plus a good speaker. But the name, when it was suggested to us, I thought he would be somebody from the West Coast. But for the first time I met him, and a few minutes before the lecture started, and then he introduced himself as the nephew of the man who was head of the isotope division of the Baba Atomic Research Center. So when he used my name for saying that I started all this isotope business, yes, I certainly encouraged it, but the man who's supplying all the isotopes, or who's built up an organization who supplies all these isotopes to all the hospitals and makes sure that the safety devices are also sent, was his uncle, Dr. Iyer. And so I was surprised to meet a very old friend's relative, near relative, who was speaking to us on the isotope business. Of course, in the delivery of isotopes, the man we must really mention is the far-sighted planning and thinking. It was Dr. Homi Bhabha. Because the Bhabha Atomic Research Center came about entirely due to Homi Bhabha, and he was really responsible for the isotope division in a way that this thing should come up and make an impact. Unfortunately, in this country, we have associated atomic energy only with weapons, or when he talks of proliferation of cells, we talk of non-proliferation and such things. But what we don't realize is how much the atomic energy establishment has done from the point of view of humanitarian solution of various problems. Some which have taken root and become so common in use that one doesn't mention it unless kind-hearted doctors like Dr. Kilara mentions it. There are other things which could have been used to great economic benefits, and like food irradiation, which has been used in Europe for the last 30 years or something like that. Here our bureaucrats are still asking, should it be done, should it not be done, whereas we know that all these things have been tried in these places on people, the taste doesn't go down, but it's not been used. You can't help that. The country has to get confidence in it itself to use all these various techniques. But you will all agree that we have listened to a most dangerous type of lecture, which means it is so clear, so well presented, that you feel that you've already become a doctor yourself and gone right. But the moment you get out of the door, you've lost everything, because the guiding spirit which produced this lecture is not there. This often happens in physics and chemistry. You get a very good lecturer, you think you've understood the whole problem, but the moment you go out, you've lost everything. But I must say that this evening should really be called the centenary lecture, in a sense, because it's exactly 100 years since radioactivity was discovered. Not Madame Curie who developed it, but by Becquerel, And it's interesting to mention the conditions of serendipity which gave rise to radioactivity. Now, Becquerel was working in some laboratory in Paris, and he had got some stones from some Congo or some place, and he had put them in the drawer at various places. And at the same time, he had put some photographic plates in these drawers. I don't know what made him, let's develop these plates which were lying with these stones for a long time. And he developed these plates and found that they had been blackened. And he was brilliant enough to associate them with the stones. And then the actual experiment was done and showing that these stones are radioactive. And that's how it was discovered. And he passed this information to the Curies. Both husband Curie and Madame Curie were great physicists at that time. Chemists. Madame Curie was more a chemist. That's why it was called radiochemie and not radiation physics. And she took it into her hands to purify these stones, I mean chemically analyze these stones and extract uranium and all its daughter products. And that was the beginning of radioactivity 100 years. And now, because this lecture was so moving from various points of view and so well delivered, I think we'll call this the centenary lecture, because we don't know when the next centenary will come. That will be another 100 years later. But this, I think, goes very well with this evening's lecture. And I thank the doctor for coming here, delivering this, and taking so much interest in his audience to make it very understandable and clear. Thank you very much, sir.